One thing that I want to come back to, but I need to lead with as well, is that just as you said, quality, we make up what quality is. It's in my social science language, it is a social construction, right? Mm-hmm. And yet it's one that masquerades as being something objective of in the world. And it's only really effective if it masquerades well, right? And then we can forget that it's a social construction, that it's meant to serve certain ends. We created it to do something. In many ways, this is what I say about markets in general as well. Mm-hmm. We often talk about ourselves as if we're servants of the market. We created markets. Mm-hmm. We can recreate them toward various kinds of ends. That could be profit maximization. It could be stakeholder distribution. It can be all kinds.
This episode is proudly brought to you by Mapper Forward's workshop, It's Time to Become a Coffee Consultant. Learn how to diversify your revenue streams and create freedom from your day job while saying goodbye to that alarm clock forever by becoming a consultant within the coffee industry or directly to consumers who have shifted towards home brewing and home roasting. Protect your income from challenging times in the coffee value chain by taking this course today. Go to mapperforward.coffee/workshops or click the link in the show notes for details. Welcome to the Daily Coffee Pro by Mapper Forward, friends. I'm your host, Lee Safar, and this is episode one of a brand new series with Ted Fisher, or Edward Fisher, as you may know from his book, Making Coffee Better. Ted, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. I'm really excited to be here. I guess a long-time listener, first-time caller, as they say on the radio.
Thank you, sir. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. I got introduced to your work through a story that Sarah, people will know her on Instagram as Sarah Writes Stories. Sarah wrote a really great story. A really great article that mentioned your work and had you quoted in it. And I wrote to Sarah and I said, should I have Ted on the podcast? She's like, yes, absolutely. Yes, you must get him on the podcast now. And so it has happened. So welcome. I'm really excited about having this conversation because we're going to talk about one of my most favorite things to talk about, which is the value in coffee these days. And the theme for this series is how is value created in the specialty coffee market? You know, it's been kind of a hot topic since SCA Expo in Chicago. We're going to talk about golden espresso machines. We're going to talk about quality. We're going to talk about comparing like and like. We're going to have a lot of great conversations over these five episodes. Before we get started, Ted, why don't you tell everybody who you are, what you do, and where this book came from?
Yeah. So I'm a cultural anthropologist at Vanderbilt University in the U.S. in Nashville, Tennessee, Music City, USA, we like to call ourselves. And I've worked for a long time. And my interest in as a cultural anthropologist are in political economic issues. And so I've worked for a long time with Mayan communities in Guatemala and looking at different ways in which they engage the global economy. I wrote a book some years back on broccoli and desire about Mayan farmers growing broccoli that gets exported to the U.S. and how the desires of Mayan farmers get attached to this and how, you know, green consumers in the U.S. also attach their desires. So I had this history of working in a major coffee producing country. And I started a malnutrition project about 10 or 12 years ago in Guatemala, and I was pitching this around looking for donors. And somebody set me up with a meeting with the Coffee Association in Guatemala. Okay. So I went in and met with a man, Bill Hempstead, there, and I was pitching my idea. And then he started telling me this story about coffee in Guatemala, that the market had changed. There had been this quality turn in the market. And that all of the old plantations in Guatemala that were famous for just, quite frankly, awful labor conditions, many of them had gone out of business as production had gone up in altitude and had moved to Mayan. So it was one of those stories that I was like, wow, I'm an expert in Guatemala, right? This sounds a little self-serving, but I'm one of the world experts on this small country. I didn't know that story.
Wow.
The story in my head was very different, was one of Germans and Spaniards coming over and practically enslaving Mayan populations and taking their land. And all of a sudden, I heard this other story. I said, I've got to investigate. Is this true? And if so, I need to find out what's going on. And so that's when I started getting involved in copy research around 2010.
My word, you know a lot about our industry.
I did spend 10 years studying you.
You really know a lot about our industry. When I had a conversation with you, I was like, wait, does he own a coffee shop? Is he got a roastery? Like, he knows a lot of people. He knows a lot about our industry. And for those who don't know, what's an anthropologist?
So that's a great question. And a lot of times at cocktail parties, people will ask me, you know, have you had any big digs lately? And I was like, well, no, I'm a different flavor of anthropology.
Uh-huh.
But what attracted me to anthropology is also what attracted me to studying coffee, actually.
Okay.
Anthropology technically is the study of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And we, since our inception, it's a relatively young discipline compared to mathematics and physics and things like that. But from our inception, we thought, let's look at the human condition in all of its aspects, the biology, the history and the ancient history, the mm-hmm. language, and the culture. And so I specialize in cultural anthropology, but I think we're starting to realize more and more through the pandemic, through global warming, through all of these things that actually biology and environment, and culture, politics, and economics, you can't separate those into little silos and treat them one by one. It's an integrated system.
Mm.
Just like the coffee, you know, why is it so attractive? That is not unrelated to it being a psychoactive drug.
Mm.
It acts on our biology and our physiology. So you can't separate the economics from the biology.
I love that. When in this episode, we're going to talk about what is quality in coffee. Now, when you say, you know, that you study humanity, you study humans, you study, you know, all of the deliciousness around that, quality really seems to be front and center of the human experience, right? And yet the idea of quality is so subjective. Just as good quality coffee is subjective. So help me understand how, when you go to approach a book like Making Coffee Better, how do you approach the idea of defining what is quality?
That's a great question. And one thing that I want to come back to, but I need to lead with as well, is that just as you said, quality, we make up what quality is. It's in my social science language, it is a social construction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's one that masquerades as being something objective of in the world. And it's only really effective if it masquerades well, right? And then we can forget that it's a social construction, that mm-hmm. it's meant to serve certain ends. We created it to do something. In many ways, this is what I say about markets in general as well. Mm-hmm. We often talk about ourselves as if we're servants of the market. We created markets. Mm-hmm. We can recreate them toward various kinds of ends. That could be profit maximization. It could be stakeholder distribution. It can be all kinds. So you're right. Quality is something that, as an anthropologist, we're interested in as the social construction, and especially a social construction that seems like it's that. But there's also the case, as anthropologists, we're famous for going off to exotic locales and studying very different peoples and customs and coming back and bringing that. When I first started studying coffee, and I really have focused on specialty coffee and really what's called third wave coffee, the high end portion of the specialty market. But when I first started going to SCA expos and to barista competitions and things like that, I entered this being someone who's a bit of a foodie. I go to nice restaurants, I drink different kinds of wine. I've lived in coffee shops, writing books and studying for, you know, ever since I was in college. I thought I was kind of with the program. I was prepared as anybody. But then when I started going to these, I was like, wow, this is a whole nother world. They have another language. there's another ethos that I really wasn't familiar with. Mm-hmm. And so then I started thinking, wow, this is it's a cultural community. And it's a cultural community based around selling a product, but it goes beyond that, right? I mean, at these events, and we can criticize and be snarky about them later, and probably will, but there's also a lot of sincerity of people being dedicated to craft, mm-hmm. artisanship, of people wanting to share cool new tastes that they found somewhere. There's a lot to be admired in that. And so I started, and so if you look at it as a cultural community like that, and then you start saying, okay, well, what are their beliefs? What are their beliefs around quality? And that's a different question than what is quality? What are the beliefs around quality? And I got fascinated with that.
What I want to ask you is, what role does manipulation play in defining quality? Because when I think about the things you're describing, the cultural experience around this thing that we call coffee, and these trade shows and these competitions, and there's this whole, what I think has at its core a really beautiful essence to it, this idea that people commune. Coffee is something that brings people together. But the more you speak to people in the coffee community, and you, if you were to say to them, does coffee create community? They'll say, no, it's bullshit. Because our industry has been, in my eyes, has been manipulated to revere an elitist endeavor that hero worships people who define what quality and taste is in an industry to serve the interests of associations and equipment manufacturers. So when you introduce that into the conversation of quality, now are you not bastardizing the essence and the purity of the ability to define what quality coffee is for each individual person?
Absolutely. I would both agree and disagree with the way in which you framed that. I think at the big level, I think that is right. I think that there is a group of elites, although again, there are always little caveats, right? Mm. Not as elite in some other sectors, right?
Right,
not elite
right.
like the financial sector elites, or not even elite like the wine sector elites. But nonetheless, there is a group of elites, the hero worship stuff, absolutely. And that they do have an outsized power in defining what quality is. We can see it in changing quality standards. It took some prominent voices to say, hey, naturals actually have some interesting taste profiles, to get it on the stage, right? And that same thing is happening with Robusta right now. A few prominent players have to sign on to saying, oh, there's something more to Robusta than we've thought in the past, and that can move everything. I think that that's right. Although I do shy away from just the term manipulation. On one hand, it is manipulation. On the other hand, it's not super coordinated manipulation, right? It's people kind of coming together. It's not like, well, this is rapidly changing with private equity buying up a lot of
correct. And I want to go back to your Robusta thing. Robusta is being pushed by governments around the world who have an agenda to have Robusta overtake Arabica for many different reasons. So there is intentional manipulation happening in the market to whether it's private equity, whether it's venture capital, whether it's geopolitical, whether it's trade embargoes in order to push certain countries' coffees in different directions so that we can state that as elite, whether it's particular varietals so that, let's say, the FNC decides that naturals are no longer allowed out, they're a defect. All of this is manipulation. Whether it's specific that's judges right. in competitions deciding that they want a particular person to win, so they pretend that they're objective and they're not objective and they let one person, all of this is manipulation. And at the that's end true. Of the day, the things that matter, which are the supply chain that enables all the different custodians of coffee to be good custodians of coffee, the attention is being taken away from that.
I think that that is true. And I guess my pushback was just that it's not as concentrated in some other. I mean, let's take wine and Robert Parker's outsized influence in red wines and particularly Bordeaux's. I mean, he can set the market, right? I mean, producers are starting to produce to his taste profile. And there's not, it's too, it's at this moment, and it's consolidating in coffee, at this moment, it's much more diffuse than that. And so, yeah, you do, among this elite, I guess is what I'm saying, you have different voices that are kind of putting different positions out there. Some of those get taken up and some of them don't. But it's not like a cabal, right? It's not like JAB gets all of their coffee ownings, intelligentsia, and Stumptown and everybody together and says, okay, this year it's going to be, you know, blue raspberry is going to be the hot flavor.
We're going to agree to disagree on that. Yeah. I get privy to a whole bunch of information that, you know, people come and tell me about stuff that they hear and they see and they say, and my jaw drops to the ground and I can never talk about it. And I guess a lot of the time people say, like, Lee, why do you think that when it can't fix this? I'm like, because I see things that happen that lead me to believe that we are stuck in a cycle where markets are being driven by people who have agendas other than what small business owners have. And anyone who believes that they have any kind of power as a small business owner, I love the idea that you believe that. But you have the kind of power that you have only until the point where they decide you can't have that power anymore. This is why unification and working together is really important.
I think that that's right. And I would say systems as much as individual players are the obstacle to those.
Yeah.
And you hit on an irony there that, right, small business owners, small cafe owners, they have to believe that they have power. You wouldn't start the business if you didn't think. You have to start with a bit of naive optimism about changing the world and making some money.
Yep. Yeah. Well, and this is why I say anyone who believes, you hear a lot, like when I ask people, why do you enter competitions? Well, because of the community. Well, hold on. It's a competition. You're competing against the people you're saying you're in a community with. That is what's fostered. I don't see many people creating any kind of networking events that are not driven by community, competition.
That's a good point. Although I would say it can be a little bit like Schrödinger's cat, like a quantum state.
Right.
It can be both.
I agree.
There is community.
A little bit of quantum entanglement there.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go with that. All right,
well,
folks.
Well, building off of what you said, let me just add one other thing.
Please.
I think that... So starting off with good intentions, a lot of these programs, Q grading and various grading kinds of things, they try and put numbers on it. Again, Robert Parker style, right? Mm-hmm. Very precise numbers. Starts from a good place of like, let's get rid of all this noise and let's focus and reward people who are doing quality. But then all these barriers get like, I mean, who can actually become a Q grader these days? And I think that they're changing. I know Michael Sheridan has just come over and taken over the Coffee Quality Institute, and he's really looking for ways to expand their accessibility and reach and stuff. But the barriers to becoming a Q grader are huge.
Well, and the purpose of it, if you're not buying green coffee, what the fuck are you doing a Q grading course for? Like, other than because you've done all the other courses, like, we have a problem in this industry where people are not focusing on the skills that they need to do their job, and they're chasing certificates. And so I take your point. Like, these things are started with the best of intentions, but they end up being hijacked. The intention ends up getting hijacked for financial gain because people want to belong somewhere, or people want to say, I've got my Q grader, like all of this stuff. And it's like, okay, but have you focused on learning how to sell? Have you focused on learning, like, what's your professional development? All of these other things you could be focusing on. Again, manipulation. Let's bring people into the things that we can sell them.
No, you're absolutely right. And it does become this huge badge of honor, right? Like we all know in the coffee world, if somebody yeah. says they're a Q grader, it gets a gasp.
Woohoo, yeah. Go for you.
Yeah, but there's also something that we touched on a moment ago. It's also that these numbers start to take on a power greater than they have. They're social constructions.
Yeah.
We've yeah. made up all the things behind them, but it starts to seem objective. Oh, that was an 87 or an 87.5. It's like, seems like that's an objective quality of the being.
Did you find that number out of nowhere, or did you specifically pick that number for something in particular?
No, I just did it out of nowhere. Is it meaningful?
Okay, everyone that is listening to this will wonder if you connected that specifically to a particular situation that happened online recently. So we won't highlight it, but those who know, know. And please, and I want people to know that you did not intend to say that number for a particular reason. No connection to anything. Go on.
Thank you. You're saving my reputation.
Yes, correct. They're going to cancel. Well, you will either get worshipped or canceled, one or the other.
Yeah. Sorry about that. But you know what I'm saying? The numbers start to seem like there's something really objective there, and it hides that there's a value judgment behind the number.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really cool that judges can be trained to calibrate their taste to get within a pretty narrow range. I mean, it's a cool sensory, intersubjective sensory exercise. Is it getting at some reality in the world? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I like that idea of like it's a construct and people are taking it sometimes a little too seriously or a little too much the wrong way, or it moves away from the essence of what it was created with a lot of the time.
Absolutely. And like you alluded to earlier, and that I talk about a bit in my book, in cupping competition, sometimes these cuppers, they're very well trained. And I think it's amazing how close they can get to each other and all of that. But sometimes they will say, you know, sometimes we're thinking they're all roasted at the same basic level there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're cupping, they're thinking, oh, when I roast this or when whoever roasts this, it's really going to be not an 82, but an 88. And so I'm going to split the difference, or I'm going to cup it how it's going to be roasted because the buyers are going to roast it that way anyway.
Yeah, and this is exactly the problem. We haven't even talked about cultural palate and the impact the cultural palate has on the idea of quality. You know, a strawberry in Thailand tastes very different to a strawberry in America. And do we take the quality one to be the one in Thailand versus the one in America? Like all of these are the kinds of things that start to impact. You know, when are you going to score it? Is the strawberry in Thailand going to give it like the 88, or is the strawberry in America going to be more favorable? Yeah, these are all really, really interesting things to ponder, right?
Absolutely. And along those lines, something I just learned recently is, I mean, blueberry is such a common tasting note, right? Blueberry is exclusively grown in the Northern Hemisphere. Blueberries are not grown where coffee is grown.
Yeah.
No small holding farmer knows what blueberry tastes like. And so there's also, that gets to this, there's quality that gets determined at the SCA in Chicago or wherever, right? Tasting rooms in Seattle. And then there's quality on the farm. And how do you communicate those?
100%. I love that we're having this conversation so that people listening at home, or in your car or in the gym. I don't know why everybody listens to this podcast in the gym. The number of people that have said to me, oh, I listen to you in the gym all the time. But wherever you're listening to this, I hope that this gets you critically thinking about what you think quality is. And the fact that whatever your perspective of quality is, isn't absolute. And that's a wonderful place for you to start like being curious about what coffee is, what, you know, the kinds of cups that you drink out of, what a quality cup is versus not a quality cup, et cetera, et cetera. Quality is hyper subjective based on so many different things. So
And I bet you get this all the time. I get it all the time, too. People coming up and saying, oh, you study coffee. You know, what's the best coffee? What's a great coffee? And of course, we all say, well, it's whatever you like is really the best to hung up. But I think that just becomes a phrase that we say. I mean, we mean it and we don't mean it. Right? We're like,
I mean,
yeah,
it.
Whatever you like is good. But actually, I do know what a 93 tastes like.
Well, and this is where I need to tip my hat to one of my best friends, Angelo. Why? Because when Angelo and I met in San Diego, I said to him, let's go grab a coffee. And he said, only if I can choose the coffee shop. I'm like, but bro, I'm the coffee person. He's like, I hate specialty coffee. I'm like, wow, awesome. Tell me more. And he said, it tastes sour and it doesn't taste right. It's like got all these fruity notes in it. I'm like, take me to where you want to drink coffee. We went there and it was Italian, like a traditional Italian coffee. And I ordered tea. I tasted his coffee. It was horrible from my perspective, but he was like a pig in shit. He was so happy. And I said to him, tell me what you like about this. He said, you know, this is the problem with your industry, not the coffee industry, the specialty coffee industry. You want to tell me that there's something wrong with me because I think that this is what specialty coffee is. And I'm like, okay, that is an important lesson. What I think is nice, he thinks is absolutely vulgar. And that was maybe 7 years ago.
And having the self-confidence to tell you that,
right?
That's where it is. And he revealed it all. Your industry is talking down to me or telling me that I'm bad. And most people get that kind of status hierarchy instantly, right? It's like, oh, I should be. I know I should like that copy, but I like this instead. Rather than just like he did, embracing what you really like.
Yeah. Which leads us to a discussion about power dynamics. So join us in the next episode, folks. We're going to talk about who has the power in the coffee supply chain. Join us for the next episode. Peace, love, and peanut butter. Have an amazing rest of your day. I really hope you enjoyed this episode, friends. Please don't forget to show us some love by subscribing, liking, commenting, and most of all, sharing this podcast with your friends. Check the show notes for links, including our sponsors and our Patreon. And stay tuned for more great conversations on The Daily Coffee Pro by Mapper Forward.